This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you ka-ching. Ka-ching. Come on, guys, we talked about this. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. And once you start selling, Shopify makes getting paid simple by instantly accepting every type of payment. What I love about Shopify is how, no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. You want to grow big? Shopify. You want to grow small? Shopify. You want to grow medium rare? Also Shopify. Shopify powers 10% of all commerce in the United States, and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
You're listening to iFanboy Talk Explode with writer Rick Remender. Welcome to another edition of iFanboy Talk Explode. My name is Ron Richards, and this time around we're talking with writer Rick Remender, writer of our favorite comic book, Fear Agent, as well as over at Marvel, the hit comic Uncanny X-Force, the upcoming Venom, and he's winding down his run on Punisher. But also, Rick was the writer of an upcoming video game called Bulletstorm, which had a little bit of controversy this past week in the news, so we thought it was high time we check back in with Rick, talk about the video game, as well as his upcoming comic work. Got a lot to talk about, so let's just dive right in. So I'm here with writer extraordinaire Rick Remender, writer of comics and multimedia video game world. How are you, Rick?
I'm good. I also do fan fiction in the porn world, in the porn industry.
Nice, but not under Rick Remender, right? You have a nom de plume there, don't you?
No, it's under Rick Remender.
Oh, okay. Yeah. No, there you go. I thought you were doing it under...
I'm proud of it.
Oh, you are? Nice.
Yeah, I mean, it is still fan fiction. I'm not a professional at it.
Right.
It's a little yellow, you know, but whatever. Right. And I mean literally, because it's mostly about urination. But it's also a little purple.
Which is even...
But literally, because it's also about, like, the hindquarters, which sometimes has purple coloration.
We're not even 2 minutes in. I love it. So we are here to catch up. It's been a while since we talked about your various projects, and thought it was good timing considering that the Bulletstorm, the video game that you worked on, it's got a little bit of attention recently. So
pre-release hype, yeah. We're in the throes of that right now.
So before we get to the thing that we probably won't be able to talk that much about, why don't you tell everybody what is Bulletstorm? How did you get involved? What's the basic premise of the game?
The people at People Can Fly, which is a satellite company of Epic, or they're owned by Epic, so they're all sort of tied together. The developer there, Adrian, is a fan of Fear Agent and Blackheart Billy and some of my other word-making projects. And he was putting together this new game. Epic, basically, after these guys had been purchased by Epic and done a few Gears of Wars thing, Epic said, you guys should just make your own game. And so as they were developing this, Adrian was apparently reading the Fear Agent comic book and wanted me to write the game. So I came in, and Adrian, you know, was a super cool guy. They're Polish. They're in Warsaw. And he said, basically, And I'm not sure if it was because he was, you know, misspeaking or if he meant it. But he said, well, just tell me what you really think. Because the ideas they had in place were like, you know, Black Ops Squad goes and does this, or, you know, some prisoners get caught and thrown into here. And I said to him bluntly, I said, well, it's shit, you know, like it's shitty. It's really shitty. And it was all about like, it was about like collecting an armor or something. And I was like, I just don't want to collect an armor. You know, I don't want to. And so, and he was like, good, good, that's what I want. Tell me, you know, tell me more. How shit is it? And I'm like, shit, it's totally shit. So we got to talking about what he liked about pulp science fiction, what I liked to talk, and, you know, what I like about it, and the long and the short is we developed Bulletstorm, which is just, you know, for fans of Fear Agent, I don't have to explain it too much. It's basically Blackheart Billy meets Fear Agent in terms of, like, tonally what I've done. And it's about a space pirate who is a former Black Ops guy, and he was betrayed by his general. And the funny part of this is, as we were developing it, you know, Adrian had all these placeholders in for the game characters, and he had Evil General as the bad guy. And so I sat down one night and I wrote a whole new thing up where it's not a general, but it's actually this blah, 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 blah. And then I went right back to it and I was like, you know what? Let's do a video game. Like, yeah, it's an evil general. That's awesome. That's awesome. Like, there's no depth. There's no more. Like, who is that guy? He's a fucking evil general. And so it was just this wild sort of embracing of every trope and every sort of, you know, archetype. And then it was like, you know, one of the things that Adrian had in there was he's got a cyborg sidekick. And I was like, you know, oh, I've got to take that out. Everything's got a, you know, metal arm on it and blah. And then I just went, no, you know, got to put that back in. And so after I shattered it and reformed it, I took some of the things from his outline and put them back in terms of the world. And I think it turned out great. Like, there are things I would never have done. Like, I always want the villain to be like, you know, it's a race of interdimensional jellyfish aliens who travel through time manipulating the time stream. And in this, it was like, evil general.
Well, I mean, that's interesting that you said that, you know, that the initial stuff he had was shit and you came in and you gave it your kind of flair. But, like, the fact that you put stuff back in, like, I mean, and that's the stuff. I mean, you're a writer, whether you're writing comics or a video game, you're writing regardless. But the fact that you can embrace what works in a video game versus what is just cliche in a comic book or whatever seems really interesting.
And I thought, you know, like, look, it might fail on that end, but I thought that was what it was interesting about it. You know, like, the more we talked, I said, look, tonally, we need to hit Evil Dead 2. There are moments of Evil Dead 2 I'm scared. When they're going down the stairs, when the lady is dancing, and the, you know, like, when the hand is crawling around, there's moments that Raimi actually scares you, but it's this campy, ridiculous scenario where it's just like a special effects warehouse in a cabin. And I thought that as sort of the tone that I wanted to embrace, that mixed with, like, Big Trouble in Little China, where it was, you know, just the things that can be fun and actually captivating without taking themselves, you know, direly serious and have this, you know, tone, which most video games unfortunately fall into. They're always trying to like make you really hate the villain, you know, like he killed 15 orphans with a nuke that he shoved in their asses, and your mission is to go to Russia and find him. And the self-seriousness and the melodrama was something that we discarded right away. And to that, if you've read Blackheart Billy, then tonally, and you play Bulletstorm, you'll see a lot of what I'm writing is that. It's that sort of irreverent kind of, you know, punk rock. I don't know what you would even call it, but so it was fun in that I had a game developer come to me, and they had this like, hey, we got a, like, you know, huge $100 million video game. Do you want to write a bunch of filthy stuff?
Did they have the name Bulletstorm going into it, or did you name it?
They did have Bulletstorm, and that was the thing that, again, I was like, this needs to be Grindhouse.
Yeah.
You know, like, this is just going to have to be. And I know that, you know, Adrian wanted that. He wanted something that was high adventure pulp science fiction. And I really did push for the B schlock and the filthy sensibility of it all. And hopefully, you know, that doesn't sink the game, because
right,
it definitely has brought about some controversy.
And that's the question. I mean, like, and it's funny because we posted up an article about some of the controversy, and we were talking about, you know, like, and it was funny that Josh, our video game guy who wrote it, you know, without any prodding from me, by the way, was very clear to bring up that you're the guy behind, you know, both, you know, Uncanny X-Force and Last Day of American Crime, but also XXX Zombies and things like
right,
that, which are very B-movie schlock. And it seems that the game pulls in, you know, a lot of that in a fun kind of way, at least from what I can tell. But it seems as if some people don't quite get the joke.
Some people.
So, and for those who aren't in the know, you know, just to give the background, Fox News came out with some comments about the game, questioning the violence and the insults and the sexual innuendos in the game, and they brought in
They said it was the worst game in the world, is what they said.
Well, which since...
and they said it will lead to rape.
So,
and I'm not paraphrasing that shit. That is straight up in the article.
It says the increase in rapes can be attributed in a large part to playing out of sexual scenes in video games.
Right? So, yeah. I mean, it totally makes sense because I'm a rapist.
Right.
So, I mean, I guess that comes across in my writing.
Right. So now, I imagine you probably, I'll leave it up to you whether you want to comment and react to anything that Fox has to say about the game or not.
You know, what's to say about Fox News? You know, why bother? God bless them. Everybody's got a point of view. I hope that nobody who plays Bulletstorm does do the rape.
Yeah, I hope so too. But so now what I find interesting is, so you wake up one day and all of a sudden everyone's talking about Bulletstorm. What was that day like?
Well, the big PR campaign is coming up, and
right.
I wrote some commercials that I can't talk about, but they feature a couple of famous guys doing a couple of ridiculous things. So the big ad campaign, you know, they always blast it out the first 10 or the last 10 days before a release. So I think the big ad stuff is coming up, and I was getting ready, and it was funny, the morning of the announcement, or the morning that Fox sort of put up their business, I did an interview with a magazine that was pre-scheduled, and it came up, and you know, I popped my mouth off for a while, and fortunately they pulled it all back in, because it was like, why stir any controversy up, or, you know, take the low road and attack them back or anything, you know, and then who does it anyway. So yeah, it was very interesting to all of a sudden, instead of like have the attention come from the fact that we've got these amazing commercials that I wrote and got a couple of comedian buddies of mine to take part in. When I was expecting the attention to come, it came from sort of left field. But you know, I'm glad for it. The game is amazing, and it's going to change. It's going to change video games. It really is.
Don't you mean the it came from right field?
Sorry.
Oh, zing!
and good night.
Yeah.
Now you gotta end the interview. That's it. You're out.
Thank you.
You gotta Costanza that shit. You gotta literally just hang the phone up. You can go, don't you mean from right field? Click, and then just run or just do your touchdown dance.
It's like I'm normally the straight guy, so I don't often get to do the punchline. No, but
I'm glad I set you up for it. It was great.
So, but you really think that this is going to be a big I'm sure you're proud of the work and everything, but you think this is going to be a major release, video game release?
Oh, I don't think it's epic. I mean, you know, epic. Gears of War is like the best-selling thing in the universe. It's a billion-dollar franchise at this point, or something. And nothing they've released. There's like, you know, two game companies in the world that just, you know, every time they release anything, it just is going to do a certain number. And Epic is one of them. And here you've got Epic partnered with Electronic Arts. You know, so. No, the game is already gold and it hasn't come out. It's already sold like whatever that is, 2 million units or, you know, 1.5 million pre-orders. So the game's going to be a big deal, you know, and between this and Dead Space, my video game writing career is going quite well. I've landed on two projects that turned into, you know, Dead Space turned into EA's biggest IP, and Bulletstorm is going to hopefully, I don't know if it can match Gears of War, but it's going to get pretty close. So I've been very fortunate in that my love of science fiction and comic books landed me both these jobs.
Yeah, that's awesome. So now, but what I find kind of funny, so you're working on the video game, and you know they knew your comic work, but I imagine when you're in Europe and they're writing in it, and you're coming up with some fairly, you know, creative, you know, terms and lines, stuff like that, did any of the video game people look at you and just like, what's with the crazy writer? Or was everybody cool with it?
Everybody was not cool with it at first. But, you know, once I got everybody sold on the space pirate concept and we were building the story, Adrian was cool for sure. There were some other people involved that needed to be convinced tonally that what I was presenting was what they wanted to do. And Adrian fought with me to keep it the way it was. And, you know, it fit. It was natural. It, in this case, it was like... it was like R-rated Bruce Campbell, again, kind of, you know, referring back to the Evil Dead 2, but the character is also a debaucherous space pirate who's an ex, you know, black ops agent assassin guy. You know, he's not a friendly guy, and I don't want him to just be like Gruff McGrefferson talking like that. But I wanted it, you know, which we got Steve Bloom, so we got the Gruff McGrefferson voice. But I wanted him saying like absolutely ridiculous things. You know, like there's a scene in the game, and I'm not sure how it plays out in the game now, but the lights get cut off from the electricity. And the lights come back on, and your cyborg buddy's standing right in front of you, and you go, "Oh, he scared the dick off of me!" And it was just the idea of getting Steve Bloom. This, you know, he did Wolverine on the old X-Men cartoons, and you know, and it's very getting Steve Bloom. "Oh, you scared the dick off of me!" And I wrote, you know, there's thousands of things like that. I just tried to make sure anytime that there was a lot of cursing that it wasn't just straight ahead cursing, but it was like, you know, right. "I've seen shit down here that'll turn your asshole purple." I think that was the first kind of cuckoo line I wrote where they were like, "Well, why would your asshole turn purple?" And I was like, "I don't know, but it's a lot more interesting than like, I've seen shit down here that'll scare the pubes off of your baby's breath McDonald's house or right. whatever." Which actually is pretty good. That's not a bad line.
Write that down.
Baby's yeah. breath McDonald's house.
But so,
oh, opium.
But so, and was there any, I mean, the fact that it was the development was done in Europe and stuff like that, there were no kind of cultural, you know, kind of them not getting
it? No, they're
it.
Actually way, way cooler about it than the Americans.
Oh, yeah?
You know, like,
cool.
Adrian, yeah, the Polish, just that wasn't the issue at all. We just had to make sure that everybody else involved from a top level was cool with it. And it took a while. I mean, like, you know, and you can obviously understand with that much money going into a game, and then all of a sudden the dialogue starts coming in with, you know, your asshole's turning purple and your dick's blowing off your body and you get, you know, dick tits and every other, you know, kind of crazy, stupid thing I'm cooking up. People are going to cock an eyebrow and go, "Well, wait a minute. We might have an issue here." But I think that once I had enough scripts finished and things were coming together and people could hear the voice actors to deliver the lines, I think everybody was, you know, put at ease. And that's what it took. It took the first couple of levels coming together with dialogue, and everybody was like, "Oh, it's funny. It works. It's good." And then the tone was set, and we moved forward.
So one thing I think a lot of I know our audience would be curious about is that, like, so as a, you know, as a comic writer, you know, you've got the, you know, 22-page format or the graphic novel format down and the stuff like that. How does writing for a video game differ? I mean, like, how many pages ended up getting generated for the game completely? I mean, and how does a video game fit into your schedule? I mean, like, is it the kind of thing where you can do a video game a year, or, you know, like, how much of your workload could, you know, video games be a part of?
The workload part, you know, what I was doing on this before was days, 5 days a week, I would do my Marvel work. And then I would have a cap time where at like 8 o'clock, I knew I had to be done. And then I was off on Bulletstorm from 8 to midnight or 8 to 2 in the morning or 8 to 3 in the morning or whatever it would be. Yeah, last year killed me. Last year was a motherfucker. Because I was also writing the Last Days of American Crime screenplay. The Last Days of American Crime comic book, the Fear Agent book, Dr. Voodoo, Punisher.
Why do people say you're a slacker? I mean, you've got this like slacker reputation, you know, like, and it just seems like you're always working, but yeah.
that guy needs to work more.
I know, jeez.
Everybody always says about me.
So yes,
you know, but it was as for, you know, you just have to schedule it out, and I couldn't turn it down. You know, it was like, again, it wasn't like they were coming to me and going like, "Hey, would you like to write a video game adaptation of The Punisher?" And which I probably wouldn't have. You know, like, I would have been like, "Yeah, I'd rather not. Just don't want to have to kill myself right now." But it was an IP with a blank screen that was going to have Epic and People Can Fly and Electronic Arts behind it. And they're like, "Hey, do you want to create a video game with the biggest game company in the world?" You know, and I'm like, "Well, yeah, you pretty much have to do that. There's no way you turn that one down." So I did that, and it was hard. And as for, you know, if another one were to come up, it would just be the same thing. I'd have to flip the schedule to the point where, you know, as it is right now, I have 3 or 4 hours a day that I take off and hang out with the family, and I would have to sacrifice that to get back in, I guess.
Yeah, and who wants to do that? But so in terms of the workload, I mean, like, is it, you know, any idea of how many words or how many pages you actually generate? I mean, just trying to put it into comic book terms, you know what I mean? Like, so people can get an idea of how much writing you did for the game.
Sure.
Because I imagine it's kind of, you write every line of dialogue, right?
Most of it, yeah. I mean, they had there was a sound engineer or somebody who had rewritten some of the chatter lines that the character says and added in things like booyah or whatever, and, you know, whatever. There's some things that are a little bro jock that I definitely didn't write, but like 98% of it is me, yeah. So, a lot, you know, it's a 5-hour campaign or something. I mean, they just dumped their asses into this. Epic doesn't do a new IP unless they're going to do it right, and so this thing is just, it's like a summer blockbuster. I mean, it's got so much love and money poured into it. And it's long as shit. It's just a huge video game. So I think it was like, you know, you add up 5 hours of screenplay time. They say it's like a page a minute. So probably generated 500 pages of script. You know, yeah. It was a lot of work, but you know, it was also something that, man, it was so nice because it's in my voice and I got to write like, you know, if Blackheart Billy, I worked for 3 years on what is in that trade paperback, available from IDW in full color for $20 right now. Blackheart Billy. but I worked so hard on that thing, and I love writing in that voice, and there's not really many opportunities to. I get to do it with Deadpool a little bit. Well, for sure, with Deadpool. But this was an opportunity to lean back into that stuff, and it was very enjoyable.
Cool, awesome. So the demo is available on Xbox 360 now, right? And although I'm not a gamer, so I don't know these things, but I heard the demo's out. People played it, but the game drops on drops. What am I saying? The game comes out on February 22nd.
Yeah.
So people should definitely go check that out, and hopefully it will be a little quieter, at least in terms of the attention, but still positive attention.
Yeah, I think that the reviews have all been terrific, and they're all going to start coming out here pretty soon. And the game itself is beyond just whatever stupid shit I have people saying, or you know, whatever dumb story stuff I came up with. There's like the most fun game that's been created in forever, and people are definitely responding to the demo in that way.
It's M for mature, and nobody should rape, and all those disclaimers that you get out there.
Yeah, totally. If I could get anything across here, don't rape.
and totally not specific to Bulletstorm, and not that you even need to respond to this, but I guess it exists in America, but I really want to meet the person who goes and plays a video game and then walks outside and is like, well, I'm just going to go do that. Like, I just don't understand that the gap between, I mean, it's,
you know, there's sociopaths and there's schizophrenics and there's nut jobs, and whatever sets them off will set them off. I fell victim to, you know, pointing at Sarah Palin during the Arizona shootings, and it's the same species. It's the same disconnected reasoning. And some level to me, putting a target sign on a politician seems like a little heavier, implication, given that we're all just really afraid that kind of idiocy is going to lead to these sorts of violent acts. But you know, a lot of the time, what we have to come to terms with is that we're there's a herd of humans out there, and like they say, 1 in 100 is a sociopath. So you've got 1 in 100 out there who feel no emotion except for to them, love is making you feel envy or you know, like ugly, weird, twisted things, and they exist. And whether, you know, they're going to listen to Judas Priest and pretend, you know, whatever.
No, I know, yeah. Oh, Jesus, crazy. Okay, well, let's talk a little more positive. It's cool. So everybody check out Bulletstorm. Check that out February 22nd. But so back to the comics world. We talked recently on one of those Marvel press conferences about your upcoming Venom series that's coming out soon.
Yes.
And now I got to ask you, and you can tell me no or whatever. I don't know what you know. So on that press call, the identity of Venom was revealed by your editor, Steve Wacker. Was that planned, or was that true? A slip of the tongue on Steve's part.
No, that was a whacker. He whackered it up.
because afterwards we're on the press conference, and Steve Wacker says the identity of it, and then is like, oh, I had no idea. And I don't know if you saw the post I wrote, but I was like, you know, he slipped and said this whole thing. And that night we're at Bergen Street Comics in Brooklyn, and someone's like, are you sure Marvel didn't just play you? And I was like, oh, those sons of bitches.
Like, no, I don't think there's any get from that, because they had big coverage set up for USA Today and all kinds of things for this week. So, no, and you know what? In his defense, Stephen Wacker was being he had just left a story conference with Dan Slott where they're figuring out a bunch of, you know, interconnecting things I can't talk about. But so he just spent hours talking about Flash this, Flash that, and then we started doing it on the phone, and he let it slip. So, you know, as long as everybody in the industry always from here calls that a whacker henceforth, I think that we'll at least get something good out of it. Oh, that dude pulled a whacker. I mean, I think that's how that's got
to
go.
It's a true honor to have something like that named after you. So, yeah, you should be proud of that. But so now the one thing that I don't think got across in my post or in any of the other coverage from that press conference was the level of interest or excitement that you had talking about this comic series. Is that you sound really excited about it. So can you share with everybody, like, what is it about the Venom concept in this book that's got you so excited?
Well, it's, you know, we don't have a globe-trotting, and I guess we do in Secret Avengers, but we don't have a single 007 globe-trotting character, somebody who could one issue be in the Savage Land, the next issue be playing poker with Dr. Doom and Latveria, and the next issue being a, you know, secret villain's base under the North Pole. I like the old 007 stuff, and I like that I like the idea of an international hero. And I also like that he's not connected in the same Nick Fury way to a giant shield-like organization. It's grounded in reality. It's the U.S. It's the Army. You know, the armed forces, basically. You know, a division of the armed forces has taken this, and it's no longer, because it would just make sense. Like, of course, at some point, just the regular old armed forces would weaponize something like this if they had the opportunity. So what gets me excited about it, beyond just like the big set pieces that we get to throw up from all the moving around, is that it all gelled together so well in a character piece. It's Flash Thompson, who is the brute, the alpha jock kind of, you know, asshole who was picking on Peter Parker, you know, throughout the Spider-Man series forever, who was also, conversely, the biggest Spider-Man fan, which sort of, you know, always put a irked Peter Parker, if you read any of those Spider-Man books, like to have this, you know, the jock bully who's picking on you be the biggest Spider-Man fan, and you have to sit there and go, that's, I'm Spider-Man, you son of a bitch. So the Venom symbiote, for what people know about that, one of the big things is that when you lose your temper, it has an end to you. Like, you know, the angrier you are, the more it can take hold and take over. So Flash, who has a temper, has to keep his temper under control while he's wearing this thing, which adds a ticking time bomb element that I like a lot. And then also he can only wear the suit for 2 days at a time before it starts to permanently bond with him. And then he starts to Hulk out and turn back into the tongue flicking Venom that we all know. So you've got two ticking clocks, always with this, his temper and the time limits that he can wear the suit. And then you throw him into a situation, and if he has to solve it with those things in mind, and, you know, you put somebody in a situation, let's say in a war-torn Eastern European country where civilians are being gunned down, well, try fighting them and not being angry. You know, like, it's like fun to write. And so for me, the enthusiasm comes from the character. Flash, and I'll be totally honest, you know, going in, I was like, ah, Flash Thompson, you know, I don't know. Well, I don't want to write the jock.
Right. Yeah.
but then I started getting into what they've done with the character and how it tied into the suit, and that Flash had lost his legs as a corporal in the Army to save a couple of other people in his platoon in Fallujah, and this happened in a Guggenheim story 3 years back, and so when I got into it and I started reading that, I'm like, you know, that's interesting. And so now we've got, and it turns out he was an alcoholic, and he's got his father was a drunken cop who just beat him all his life, leading to his anger issues. And, you know, like, I've written enough alcoholism that I was done with it for a while. But then this came up and I was like, well, I'm going to do it again. Cause you know what? This is a big part of the character. And for somebody with an addictive personality, who is a person with a disability, who has had his legs removed in service to his country, all of a sudden not only being able to walk again, but to dive off of helicopters and to run through, you know, the Savage Land and to swing around the city on webs, but then to have to give the suit back up. If you have an addictive personality and you're using the Venom suit, holy shit, that is ripe with possibilities for story, you know, like, so all these elements that were falling in place as I was talking to Dan Slott and Stephen Wacker about their plans and what they had kind of seen as the setup, the more and more we broke it open, the more and more it really naturally fit and perfectly, like where, you know, it wasn't, I didn't feel like, I've turned down a lot of jobs recently because I'll start digging into them and realize I'll never have that connective point. I'll never have that point where I see this specific character working with this specific power in a way where it's like, it leads, this has got a terrific high concept. You know, and so that to me is where the excitement comes from in terms of writing, because I come up with a storyline. I have a villain. I have my bullseye, which is going to be Jack-O-Lantern. You know, who we're gonna try and update and really make him awesome.
Which I saw the colored page that you posted on Twitter, which looked awesome.
Oh, it's so cool! Yeah, beyond the visuals, I think we got a lot of good hooks with the character that we'll reveal down the line, and we got a lot of big crossovers we're talking about right now. Two really big ones that'll be just terrific and help sort of solidify the character in the Marvel universe as well as his own little corner. But and then obviously beyond all of that stuff, it's back with Tony Moore, and you know, oddly enough, like Tony and I approached it with a little trepidation. But it turned into, like, this might be our best thing. Like, it's kind of perfect because it's got monsterism in terms of when the suit venoms out, you know, it's got these things that Tony naturally does better than most anyone else. And it's got, it's fast action. It's big set pieces. Tony loves backgrounds and he loves setting scenes. And this thing turned into, like, as we're doing it, you know, I just put the first issue to bed and it's great. It's really, really fucking good. And Tony and I were talking, and I'm like, did Venom somehow become the thing we were supposed to do? <You know? laughs> Like, it was at first just like this fun thing, and then looking at it, I'm just blown away. It's like, this might be the best thing we've ever done. It might be a perfect mix of all the things we've wanted. So I hope that comes across and people agree. I know that the sales in the book have been tremendous, so hopefully the reaction to what we've done will also be.
It's interesting because and this came up on the press conference as well, is that you know Venom's one of those characters. Venom is one of those, you know, the Todd McFarlane connection and the 90s and the fad. Yeah. And like, you know, like it, you know, in the 90s it was the joke, how many books can Wolverine and Venom get into? And right. And you know,
and the Punisher.
Yes, and the Punisher, correct. Yeah. And you know, as far as you know, Venom getting his own miniseries and things like that, you know, and making, you know, Lethal Protector and all that kind of stuff, you know, and the you know, taking it to the antihero, but somewhere along the lines Venom became a joke. And yeah. I think even more so with the way he's been handled in the past couple of years with the Thunderbolts and stuff like that, where it's just like, oh, you know, like it just didn't make a lot of sense. And, you know, so when they announced that this ongoing series, I mean, I'll be honest, I had the same reaction. I was like, really? Another Venom series? Like, how are they going to do this, this time? But I gotta give you credit, though. I gotta give you guys credit that I really like the ticking time bomb aspect of it. And you know, not only in terms of wearing the suit, but also the limitation of how many times he can wear the suit, because then it becomes a, you know, so do you, I mean, and are you going to see situations where they've got to make a decision where, okay, we need to deal with this, but we can't use the suit because of that limitation?
Oh my God. Yeah. And what happens when Flash and Peter Parker are hanging out, you know, and like, what happens if Venom and Spider-Man ever meet issue 4? What if Peter were ever to find out that it's Flash? And what if the suit remembered who Peter was? And oh my God, drama! And the drama, like I wouldn't have done the book at this point in my career. I'm in a nice situation where I can turn things down for the first time. And I think that Tony and I together wouldn't have done this if we weren't both like, it's really fucking good. You know, like the high concept that Dan and Steve put together on this is really good. And as I got on the phone with Dan and Wacker and spent days and weeks and days and built it and beat it and tore it down and built it back up, it was all just getting better and better, you know. And so we at that point we have utter, you know, the utmost confidence of what we're doing. And like, you know, again, that I have no idea what fan reaction will be based on that, you know, like the high concept and the limitations of the, you know, you've got a plot ticking time bomb in that he can only wear the suit for 2 days before it takes him over, and you've got a character ticking time bomb in like, keep your temper under control, you brute jock. So you're really set in a nice place with that stuff. You know, and we also had similar things with Frankencastle, where he had to have the pills or else he started to hulk out and lose his mind. I like setting up limitations for the characters and giving them an Achilles heel that can be exploited that they have to overcome, and then the kinds of situations you put them in to overcome their weaknesses sort of define them. So in this case, I don't know what people like or don't like. I know that Tony and I are really excited and giving it all we've got. And if you like Fear Agent, if you like what Tony and I have done on things like Frankencastle or Triple X Zombies or any of the other jive we've done together, that you'll like this too.
So now from a behind the scenes kind of standpoint, it's interesting because from what I can tell as a guy on the sidelines, you know, watching what goes on, quite often, you know, the guys at Marvel tend to fall under editorships, you know, so like there's guys, you know, previously under Axel, but like in the X office or in the, you know, the kind of Mac side of things, and there's the Avengers office and there's the Spider-Man stuff. And you, as far as I know, you've been working mainly with Axel from an editorial standpoint, but now you're working with Wacker in the Spider-Man office. Does that change much the way stuff gets done, or is everything done pretty much consistently? It doesn't matter what kind of quote unquote office it is.
You know, there's differences in everybody's style, and it takes a while. Wacker and I worked together on 1 Month to Live, which was a personal project to both of us and something that we both put a lot of love into, and very mindful of the fact that it wasn't going to be a sales bonanza, but it was something that we were going to be proud of, which. It's still something that, you know, that it's why I work so hard and why I want to do this. I just want to leave behind good books. And so does Wacker. And I think on that project, it was a test for both of us to sort of see how our sensibilities fell in line and how we worked together. And for me, like, I've always respected the shit out of him. And I, you know, he and Axel's office were the kind of the two offices I wanted to be in. And so I've been chasing Wacker for years. Like, that's not an exaggeration. I've been like, hey, man, we should work together. I like to work with you. Hey, you want to work with me? Hey, look over here. and like, sending him, like, pitches all the time. I'm like, hey, me and Eric Canetti should do something. Just bugging the shit out of him. And then we finally did the 1 month to live together. And it was a great experience. And he really made me write away from my comfort zone and to get into, you know, a place of things that I really like, and, you know, and philosophical points of view and real drama and human conflict on a level that doesn't deal with fists. Anytime I would lean to pulp or any of my big idea stuff, he would go, no, ground it. That's not this. And it was, I don't know. I mean, I always gauge my experiences with an editor based on how much I learned from them. And I learned a lot and wrote something that I'm incredibly proud of that was in a completely different style than anything I'd done prior to that. So
I loved 1 Month to Live. I thought that was great. It was one of those things where I didn't quite know what to make of it, and I picked it up on a lark, and it just was totally grabbed me, and I thought each issue added to the whole thing, and there's some great work on that series, and I wish more people actually will read it. You know, now, hopefully now it's collected, it'll reach to some more folks. It was a special one.
Yeah, I hope so. And, you know, it's a nice hardcover out there, and you know, as well as a trade. So I know everybody at Marvel was really proud of it, and it was something that... It was not a work for money, you know. I put in five times more time on that developing a human story than I have. I put in equal amount of time launching, you know, X-Force and Venom, but obviously that'll have more payoff and royalties and stuff if I'm speaking in terms of just finances. But 1 Month to Live was something where once Wacker came to me with the high concept and that he wanted to create this whole thing from ground up, it was an opportunity to see A, how we work together, and B, write something that I was totally uncomfortable with. And as a, we've all had cancer in our family, and without getting into details, you know, I have as well. And maybe not everybody has, but most of us have.
Right. Yeah.
You know,
it's a reality. It's a reality that everyone's got to deal with. Yeah. So.
Yeah. And if it's not cancer, we've all lost someone we care for and dealt with mortality. And it was nice to get to write about that. But during that process, you know, I like working with Steve. So it was like, I kept bugging him, and I mean, I kept bugging him for anything. I just, you know, when you find an office that you like, I don't mind. It's, you know, I don't mind chasing. And so I chased him, and he gave me, the Venom, Deadpool Venom backups and the What Ifs that came out in the last 6 months, which I think they're collecting in one issue, which was just like, you know, he said, go crazy. And I was like, all right.
You certainly, I read those, and you did go crazy.
I went crazy.
I think the Boy George Watcher is the one that got me the most.
I think that the thing I got the most mail from was when Peter and the symbiote were separated, and the symbiote merged to Wade Wilson, and Peter was falling to his death as Billy Ocean flew away in his limousine. And Peter said, "Save me, Lord Mephisto." That was the thing.
Yes, yeah.
That was the thing that I got like a bunch of mail from. But anyway, so I was, you know, I've worked with tons of great guys at Marvel. Like, I've had a lot of really wonderful experiences. But when it really clicks, you know, as it has in Axel's office with Axel and Sebastian and Jody and the guys I've worked with there, and now with Tom and Alejandro and Steve in his office. You know, it's incredibly fortunate. Like, I feel like for the first time in my mainstream career, I'm where I belong in two places. And Janine, I actually had an interesting conversation with Janine Schaefer when we were in New York this last week for the retreat, where she was mentioning something, and I'm hopefully not overstepping a boundary by revealing the story, but she had a story that was from Project Greenlight, where a lady on there had tattoos on her hands. And her whole philosophy was, if she's ever shaking someone's hand and she feels embarrassed about the tattoos, she's in a place she doesn't belong. And I liked it. I liked it so much. And Janine told me this before, the night before. We'd just done the X-Men retreat, and it was the night before I did my first big, you know, Marvel Universe full retreat. And it was like, you know what? It was great, because it's so true. You know, like, if things don't work out in a place and you don't fit in, it's because you're not supposed to be there. And it was very helpful, but I think in terms of like my career and where I'm at Marvel, I feel like I found where I belong in terms of the offices I'm in now. And as a kid who grew up reading Spider-Man and X-Men comic books, it's a treat, you know, and to be able to. And Tony and I talk about this all the time. You know, it's like I get to work with Tony and Jerome and guys like Esad and you know, all there's so many amazing guys coming up. And take these things that were maybe discarded and thought of as you know, refuse of the 90s. And turn it into something hopefully badass. And I would much rather be the guy taking that stuff and elevating it if I succeed, which, you know, I haven't completely done yet. But if I do, I'd rather be that guy than simply just maintaining a title that's already at the top level and getting ass.
And that's a good segue because another, you know, kind of 90s trope, whatever, was the X-Force, and with Uncanny X-Force, and you're saying you don't know if you succeeded. It was the number one book. It's top the sales chart. That's
Marvel pushed it very. You know, I mean,
true,
there's a lot to be said for a Wolverine book with Marvel.
Yeah, but don't discount the. I would have to wonder if. I feel as if it was pushed in the right way, because I'd have to wonder if it was an X-Force that was X-Force has been done before. And like honestly, I don't think the last iteration of X-Force, the gray and black outfits with the red eyes and the Kill Force stuff right before you came on. That was never a number one book. So I think it definitely had to do with the concept and what you and Jerome brought to the project in addition to Marvel's push to it. Because, I mean, hey, I'm an X guy, I'm a mutant guy. We talked about it. I was cautious because I'm, you know, not the biggest Deadpool fan and all that sort of stuff. But this first arc kicked ass. I mean, like, this is – X-Force is now the book that we recommend to people as this is the X book you should read. That if you don't know anything about the X-Men, pick up this one. So
it means the world to me, Ron.
Sure.
It really does. You know, I mean, there is a part of you that goes into X-Force where you're like, oh, I wanted to write X-Men. And I'll be honest, you know, that like when I was pitching for it, I was like, should I hold off and maybe try and get an X-Men book? I was like, what? Who gives a shit? It's five really cool X-Men characters on a team that can have their own base and be self-contained stories that don't have to be completely interconnected. You know, like I'm doing my own event stuff coming up with it that doesn't connect to anything. And that's kind of the beauty of it. I don't have to connect with what's specifically going on at Utopia or with the rest of the mutants at any one time. I can be off on side missions and, you know, people are like, well, where does that first arc fall in continuity? Somebody at the show was asking me. And I was like, oh, I don't know, but it doesn't matter. Cause if you read it from beginning to end, it takes place in a period of like 8 hours, you know? It's not like just because it took you 4 months to get all four issues, it didn't take them 4 months to fight this guy, fly to the moon, fight that guy, and end the story. I mean, that was like an 8 hour, maybe 12 hours. So the great thing is that I can take these characters off the board and go off and do great missions that take place in like over a day or two or three, And they're not going to be missed from Utopia while they're doing that. And then they come home and they're like, hey, we just had an adventure.
We can't talk to you about.
Totally secret adventure. High five. So, yeah, and you know what? If we can do, like, look, I'll be honest. Like, my goal is to make the best X-Men comic on the stands, whether it's called X-Force or X, you know, Frankenbeans or X whatever, you know, like my goal is to make a X book that blows the shit out of everybody's expectations. And I'm a big fan of the X stuff, so it's a treat to get to do it, and it's a treat to get to dig back into these characters and, you know, that I've been a big fan of forever, and to, you know, really get to dig into Phantom X and Psylocke and all of them, you know, and try and find a way to make. I've got the Deathlok story has a beat at the end I just wrote with Deadpool that I think has so much heart. I felt so good about it. Like, I wanted to hug Deadpool at the end of it. You're going to be okay, man. You know? Like, you know, when you're connecting with characters like that, that, you know, hopefully people will also respond in the same way. And I'm having a real emotional reaction to what we're doing. I'm working with Jerome and Esad, and you know, we've got a couple other big artists I can't talk about coming up for some huge, huge craziness that I can't talk about.
Oh, man. That's not bad.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's... And people have been responding incredibly well to it, and it's great, you know, because again, my big fear was that because it's X-Force and not X-Men, that I was immediately going to be sort of relegated into the B-list with the book. And, you know, we've all unfortunately got it, you know, in our heads, Jerome and I and Tony have talked about this, that the inherent craft doesn't matter. What matters is how you fit into continuity. You know, and did your book move forward continuity as much as the other book? And it doesn't matter if it was beautifully lettered by Todd Klein or if it was lettered by a buffalo, you know, and like what matters is like, oh, that character lost a leg here. Big, important issue. You're like, yeah, but it was bad. And they're like, they don't care. They care that character lost leg. Character lost leg.
It's true. You're right. I mean, we've gotten. And that's part of, for whatever reason, that we've been. You know, I don't know how it happened, but we've been socialized into only caring about the books that quote unquote matter.
Matter. Yeah.
Yeah.
You should care about the books that have craft.
Yeah.
You know, like,
and that are good.
The good books, and that should, you know, like me saying this to you, probably not going to change much, but it's, you know, and I know we share similar sensibilities, so it was nice anyway to get the long rambling out of the way about your nice compliment.
Yeah. Well, so now
it was nice that people responded to X-Force this way, and hopefully we'll continue to.
So I got to ask you while I got you, I love the idea that they have their own base. Who was it, your idea or Jerome's idea to put up paintings of the other teams?
Oh, that was me. And I got I even got some flack for that because it was seen as potentially being masturbatory, but
oh, it was fantastic. That was the kind of thing that hit, as an X-Men fan, that hit the right note for me perfectly, because it was like,
yeah,
you know, Warren would do that, you know, like this is his life, and you know, like it made total sense. Like, oh,
yeah, it added heart to it. And
yeah,
we've all read these things. Look, you have to, like, here's the line: you have to find a way to incorporate the continuity in a way that gives it heart and has an emotional resonance that actually has some sort of substance to it. And you have to discount the rest of it, you know. Like, I'm not gonna sit around and worry that Betsy's continuity got kind of guffed up for 10 years. I'm gonna focus on what works. I'm gonna focus on what I like. I'm gonna respect it, and then I'm gonna move forward and tell a story. And I can't, you know, be slavishly tethered to, you know, 30 years of it. In terms of that stuff, it's like if I show a little bit of Betsy with her brothers. I'm not going to treat that as if it's something that you should just know. I'm going to treat that like, oh, did you know Betsy's brother is Captain Britain and her other brother Jamie is a crazy guy who controls reality?
But I wanted to follow up on the whole character thing, because, you know, the characterization in story versus whatever, because the X-Force concept of X-Force as, you know, the killing team has been around for a couple of years. And that first, and the, sure, my problem with it was that it was always like, how gritty can we be, and we're going to kill, and
right,
it just had no depth to it. And yet you're doing the same thing with this, but it just seems so much deeper, you know.
But we're not killing. I mean, every kill in here,
right,
like there's what, the only kills that we've seen really, Wolverine kills a bunch of fodder types, the Akabah Society warriors, and this is necessary, as these guys, as we know, will empower Apocalypse to do a lot of nasty stuff, and then not to give it away, but you know, there's another big kill at the end. And for me, it's like the same thing with the Punisher. You can go through and count my body count. It's not that high. You know, like it's not, and hopefully if there is a kill in there, like it's when the Punisher puts a gun to the back of the head of a Firebrand and tells him to torch his family. And then after he torches his family, he brains him. You know, hopefully that when there are kills by these characters, because I keep getting, I'm sort of a liberal dude. I keep getting all these assignments that like I'm drawn to, strangely, that are about murdering. But I guess it's like fun because I get to explore it a little bit. And in terms of these X characters, like, you know what? If they're Apocalypse is Hitler in terms of what he'd do, much worse. He's Cosmic Hitler. And do you go kill Cosmic Hitler? Probably. You probably do. If you're Wolverine, if you're a former assassin and you're like, hey, you know what? Cosmic Hitler's on the moon. We got to go kill him. And then I start thinking about, and one thing that Axel and I did a lot, and Jody and I do now on the new stuff, is every single arc, the mandatory thing is that it's not just a kill. It has to have a kill. You know, are we going to kill Apocalypse in the first one, or we're going to kill the future in the second one? And then some of the other kills are going to blow your mind. But not just a kill, but it has to have an ethical slippery slope where they don't just get there or on their way there and go, time to bathe in your blood, my friend. It actually offers up, it's actually something that hopefully offers up some philosophical questions and puts them in ethical quandaries.
Yeah, and I think you handled the Apocalypse. I mean, it definitely didn't end the way I thought it would. I was kind of curious how you were going to, I knew where you were going, but how are you going to get there with it and what would happen? And I didn't see that coming. So, and I don't want to spoil it for people that haven't read it, but
I think I probably already did.
Yeah, probably, but still. Because that's the thing is, like, a lot of it, like, especially with the Venom reveal and then with the recent, Human Torch death, and even going back to the Captain America death, I realized, like, right after the Captain America death, I realized, like, sometimes, like, the days of, oh my God, Darth Vader's Luke's father are over. Like, we just have to accept that. Like, you're gonna find out what the reveal is all the time. And now it's more about, How did that story happen? Like, how did you get to that point? That's what I'm more interested in.
Yeah, and that there's a lot of, and that's why we all like our DVD commentaries, in the Criteria Collection, where we get to hear, Francis Ford Coppola's thoughts as he's, living in the jungle for 7 months or whatever, or 2 years. I think that it's interesting to hear people's thought process, and we like to know that the writer has a lot of thought put into the story. He's making us read, I'm not forcing anyone to read anything, but I like to know that what I'm reading isn't just somebody who's shitting out page after page and just hacking. I like to know that the story was written in advance and reworked and reworked and reworked, and then it was cut down. Like this, the first arc was cut down from 7 issues to 4.
Oh, really?
Every unnecessary thing in there. That fight with Wolverine and Death was an issue. Like there was a whole thing inside the base with Ozymandias. There was all. There was so much that I month by month, Axel and I would just whittle it away, and if it was unnecessary, we did it with the first Punisher arc too, that Jerome and I did. And we did this on Frankencastle, the first 6 issues anyway, where the entire outline was written, and then it was written and rewritten. I'm up to issue 19 right now in X-Force, and I've rewritten the outlines like 10 times each for everything up until that point. I work, like, by the time I'm done with the amount of work I put into these things, I'm making like 25 cents an hour or something. There's so few people who read comics anymore, and we're charging $3 or $4. I got to feel like, look, like Tony and I talk about this all the time. We want to make sure when you read our comic, you felt like you just read 3 of somebody else's comic. And that's a lot more work. It means you got to write more story. You got to like scrutinize every scene and see what you can cut and what you have to keep. And by that point, through that scrutiny, you come back to a place where all that's left is the cream. And if it seems effortless, that means it's not, in terms of what you're reading and what's going into it. And so when I hear other writers or directors or people talk about their craft, I enjoy that a lot too. And you're right, the reveal days are over. You're probably going to know the end of your piece of entertainment through other means before you get to it, unless you're getting it hot off the presses or watching it, on first airing. And that's just the reality. But there is a lot of, if the person, has a lot of, if there's been a lot of thought put into the work, it's always interesting to hear how they got there.
Yeah, exactly. So speaking of how we get there, where we're going, at least, so fans of X-Force, you know, what can you tease about the upcoming arc? You know, we mentioned it's going to involve Deathlok. Where else is it going to go that you can tell us at least?
Yeah, I can talk about that arc for sure. We're getting ready to ramp up for that thing. I think the first issue comes out in a couple weeks. I'm super, super proud of it. We've got, it's done now, and the artwork is on par, or if not. Jerome and Assad are both, you know, it's such a treat to work with. I think they're on the same level. They both are godlike artists. And the idea for this one was something that when, and it goes back to, I had been planning this all the way back to when Jason Aaron did his Deathlok arc in Weapon X. We got on the phone as he was starting to plan that out, and we planned out a two stories, his story and then my story. I didn't know it was going to be an X-Force adventure at that point. I just knew that I had this Deathlok story, and it fit in with the world and a couple of other things. And as it developed, it sort of fit for this book and perfectly kind of came together. But so the Deathlok stuff, you know, something that Jason and I are both fans of, and given that this is, you know, it's the Terminator long before the Terminator movies, you know, so people are like, well, that's like the Terminator. You're like, no shit? Yeah. Which was in a comic book like 10 years before that movie came out, you know, like, it is like the Terminator, and it's Marvel's Terminator, and it's the Terminator that predates the Terminator. It's like, you know, when people were like, ah, oh, geez, that New God stuff sounds a lot like Star Wars. Yeah, crazy. That's crazy. That's because in comics, everything is better first.
And how many issues is the arc going to run?
I'm meandering quite a bit. It's a 3-issue arc. That's the thing about X-Force, is all of our arcs are going to be 3- and 4-issue arcs, so that there's no fat, there's no middle second act issue where you're like, well, that was a lot of shit. You know, I never want you to pay $4 for a comic with my name on it and go, well, that was unnecessary. The way we've got it planned now is every issue of X-Force up until issue 17, every issue has a giant big beat. So it's all one big story. From issue 1 to 17, one big story. The Deathlok stuff interconnects very nicely into it all. The world, obviously. Everything seeded in this story plays a big, big role in the giant, giant event stuff that we've got coming up. Beyond just all of the, you need to read this because it's going to be big, it's an incredibly fun story. You've got a future where we introduce a new character named Father, and Father is the architect of the world. And if you don't know what the world is a giant city dome structure, like a baseball field, that the Weapon Plus program created to design sentinels and warriors and super soldiers. And the Weapon Plus program is connected to creating Captain America and Nuke and Wolverine and Deadpool and Phantom X and Ultimate and all these other really cool characters. And so the world is basically a place where you can hyper-evolve something or devolve it if you want, because you can control the stream of time. So if you throw somebody in the world and you want to, you know, see what happens to the growth on their neck, you hyper-evolve time, that, you know, click on the outside, they age quickly, and then you can open it and no time's passed for you, but now they're 80 years old. So long and the short of it is in Jason Aaron's The List special, Phantom X got a shrink ray. He shrunk the thing down, and now he keeps it in his pocket. I'm just trying to get around the beats here without giving anything away.
Sure, yeah, no, I'm just laughing. I love A, that concept, and I love that Jason Aaron wrote that, because whenever he writes wacky stuff, he like, because he's got this, you know, he looks the way he looks, and he writes, you know, scalped and all these sort of things. But then when he throws these wacky curveballs, I love it because it's like unexpected. So,
yeah, it's great. I mean, that stuff, like, Jason and I really have similar writing styles and our pulp sensibilities in terms of going a little crazy with things. You know, sort of his Ghostwriter arc and my Punisher arc, I feel, have a lot in common. But so, you know, Jason and I cooked this thing up with the Deathloks where, you know, my basic idea was that in the future, somebody launches the Deathlok program to go out and to start killing superhumans and supervillains, and then to bring them in and then to turn them into Deathloks as well. So you slowly begin to acclimate every superhero and supervillain on the planet into the Deathlok program, and now they're easily controlled police force that usher in utopia. There's no more villains and superheroes fighting. There's no more environmental catastrophes. There's no more anything. There's just an army of Deathloks that police the world and keep it safe. And there's one last resistance fighter, and we don't know who that is, but these Deathloks, made up of Captain America and Spider-Man and Elektra, are sent back from this future to the present to kill Phantom X and to protect the world. And those are their objectives. And we slowly reveal why throughout the series, have a hell of a lot of fun doing it.
Sounds great. Sounds cool. I love the future stuff is always great. That's why I was glad. I really enjoyed the Deathlok story and the Wolverine Weapon X storyline. So good to see it continuing here in X-Force. So that's cool.
Yeah. One thing Jason did in that list issue that he did, the Wolverine, the list, was Norman Osborn threw down a file that it was acquired from the world that just said Project Deathlok. And so that was, he definitely left a nice trail there for me to put together in this story. And isn't that what this is all about? You know, like when it comes down to it, if your buddies are making really cool stories and you can pick them up and run with them, that makes comic books so much cooler. You know, Jason and I were talking about the chain of events. Jason, Grant Morrison starts this, he starts the world, he starts Phantom X, he starts, X, Y, and Z. Jason takes it and does this and this. Tie in Deathlok, tie in, the X characters, and all of a sudden it naturally comes to this really wonderful place by the seventh issue.
Cool. Excellent. It's very collaborative, long-term collaboration. That's interesting. So
it is, that's what I love about the interconnected universe is everybody puts down their egos and works together. And, after issue 17 of X-Force, there's going to be some things that Jason's picking up from my book. We just kind of hand threads back and forth and hopefully interconnect things in a way that feels exciting.
Cool, excellent. Look at you making good comics and playing in continuity.
Yeah.
So the other book of over Marvel that you're well known for is Punisher, and Frank and Castle came to an end, and now we're currently in the Punisher miniseries. What is it? It's in Cold Blood, or what is it called? In the blood.
Dealing with it's all family stuff. So yeah. In the blood.
So what I thought was interesting was that it was the move from an ongoing to a miniseries format, and it seems as if the Punisher. You've been working on Punisher for a while, but now, like, is the future of the Punisher in Marvel, at least in the 616 Punisher, going to be in this miniseries format that you know of, at least? Or
I don't think that it. I don't know. I mean, I do know, but I can't say anything. So yeah,
fair enough.
I know that. They do this on books, like they did it for Jason Aaron's Ghost Rider. Where his last five issues were their own miniseries. I think the thinking behind this is that it'll help denote that it's the last arc of a big run. In terms of formatting, it helps with that. And, the stuff that Roland Bashi's been turning in, the fourth issue of it comes out in a couple weeks. And I don't know. I mean, at this point, people who've been reading the arc are reading it and enjoying it. And if you haven't read it, jumping in now probably doesn't make a whole lot of sense because it is, again, I tend to write these 25 issue stories. And In the Blood is definitely the last five issues.
But I will say, if somebody wants to jump right into it, the art has been I'm enjoying seeing the culmination of with the Henry and the Punisher and stuff like that, and that storyline. But the art has blown me away from issue to issue. I've just totally been enjoying it. So
yeah, and Roland is godlike. Roland and Dan Brown together are just crazy good. To where like I get tired of saying it. Like it's too good. It's so good that it's that people don't know, can't understand it. And I don't mean people in general, like I'm some, elitist asshole. I mean, I think that he's the kind of good where you have to almost be an artist to appreciate what he's putting in and the difficult poses and the kind of backgrounds that he's putting together and his use of spotting blacks and the mood. And if you have been reading My Punisher and you are reading this, I'm positive you're going to enjoy the ending. It's been something we've been building to since the first arc. It brings in the Jigsaw Brothers in a way that there's so many surprises and big things coming, and it has such an emotional climax at the end. And we go to a place that I don't think people will expect us to go to, which is important, but it's natural at the same time. And Hopefully it'll, you know, if nothing else, you could just buy it to look at Roland's artwork, because the big fight sequence stuff coming up in issue 4 and 5 is well worth the price of admission.
And admittedly, the reveal of the female antagonist was quite the mind fuck as well, even for a longtime Punisher fan. You know, like, you know, which I, and that's the thing, is that I think, like, even, you know, yes, it ties into a lot of the work that you've been doing on Punisher over the past couple of years, but even as a, you know, someone just getting back into the Punisher, I still think you can connect with it and enjoy it. You know, that's why I think this miniseries has been unique in that way.
Sure. Well, and if you're not moving the characters forward and doing big things, then you're just sort of, I don't know what you're doing. You're just sitting in stagnant water being like, I've been safe with continuity,
right,
everyone.
Exactly.
You know, and I would rather not be safe with continuity and shock people and tell interesting stories that we haven't seen. And that's what I've really tried to do with The Punisher. And that's fucking hard.
Yeah. So is this miniseries your kind of last swan song in The Punisher, or will you be continuing to work on the character?
I will not. This is it.
This is it.
And I've written the last issue, and I was I was listening to some on Mon on Marth while I was writing it, and you know, like running around my office, going like, and then in the building's burning, and Frank picks up the butcher knife. You know, and I invoked the spirit of the nerd gods and. Got high in banana peels and just pounded at the keyboard for, you know, a couple days. But the Roland's pages are coming in, and it's great. I'm so, so happy with the ending. And I've changed the last two issues have no Frank captions, which I just was in New York with my editor, Sebastian, talking about this. And throughout the series, I've kept you in Frank's head, you know, but with terse bursts of, like, sort of thought, you know, just quick bursts of what Frank is thinking and his impressions of things. And in the last two issues, I cut them all. I don't think you should know anything Frank's thinking. And all of a sudden, it just turns into this totally different comic book.
Oh, wow. That's cool. Very cool. So did you enjoy the time of The Punisher? I mean, it was a good few years that you had there with the character. And it was definitely a different, you know, he's an icon of Marvel, you know.
Sure, yeah. And I'm crazy proud of what we've done. You know, I think there's maybe two issues or three issues throughout the whole run that I'm not entirely thrilled with. You know, but geez, if you include the list in the annual, and you know, was it 21, 26, 27, 28? We did 28 issues, and that doesn't even include my 6-7 issues with Fraction on War Journal. Just the arc that I've put together here is a 28 issue arc, I guess, from beginning to end. I mean, goddamn, yeah, I'm really proud of it. The stuff Jerome and I did, the stuff that Tan and I did, John Romita Jr., Jason Pearson, Tony Moore, Dan Brereton, Roland Bocci. I mean, it's been a real treat. Yeah, I think that, I truly believe if you sit down and read it from issues 1 to the end, you get one big satisfying story. And, you know, I know, and just talk about an omnibus, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah, cool, excellent, awesome. So that kind of covers some of the Marvel stuff, but then there's the fan favorite, our longtime favorite Fear Agent, which is getting closer and closer to the dreaded end that none of us want to see happen.
Well, hopefully it'll be a good end.
Yeah. So how's wrapping up Fear Agent coming along?
It's good. It's on me now. The you know, issue 31 has been done for months. They just held it off from going to the distributors because they wanted 32 wraps so that the two last two issues ship within a couple weeks of each other. The art's done for 32. I've done most of the scripting, but I just can't let it go out the door. It's just not perfect yet, and so I'm going to be rewriting issue 32 for the next 7 or 8 years.
I was going to say, do you think it's a little subconscious activity going on there?
Just prolonging it. Like, even my wife, John Lucas and Tony Moore and everybody, John actually was inking off of Mike Hawthorne's boards, and Mike would draw it, and John would blue line it and print it, and then Tony Moore would do all the faces and detail stuff. So those guys were doing like a three-way tag team on the art. And today, John Lucas sent me the last page of the last issue, and I pulled it out of the box, and Danny got all teary-eyed, and I was like, I'm the one supposed to be like, what are you kidding me? She's like, it's just, that's the end. It's, you know, I'm very alone. Like, it's a comic book, come on. If it becomes profitable, we'll do more. Again, we're whores.
Yeah, you know? Totally. So, but it's, Total horse. But the one from this story arc, at least, that's been going on, the one story that seems that everyone's been talking about has been the art, has been the jam fest that's been going on between Tony Moore and Mike Hawthorne and John Lucas, and it's been probably what's already a strong art book to begin with. It's going out with one of the strongest teams, I think, of the whole series.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's hard to say. It's so much good stuff. I mean, there was two issues that I inked Tony that are probably the best because I inked them. But the rest of the stuff is also kind of pretty good. The book has been, and that's why, I mean, I was talking to Jason about this in New York. You know, Scalped came, it launched like 2 years after Fear Agent, and I remember at a certain point when Scalped bypassed Fear Agent in the numbering, I was like, oh, your book launched 3 years after ours, and you just caught up. And I realized that I'm still sitting on issue 32, like polishing every single line of dialogue, and Scalped is inching towards, you know, what, 50 or something? I don't know. And that has great art too. Amazing art. I'm not in any way diminishing that, but it's just been very important to us that every issue of Fear Agent be perfect, or at least what we think is perfect. And so you've got Jerome Opeña and Tony Moore and Kieran Dwyer and Mike Hawthorne and John Lucas. And that's the core guys, you know. It's always mostly been Tony and Jerome, but we've had a lot of help from Mike Hawthorne, a lot of help from John Lucas. Kieran Dwyer did pencils for a couple issues that Jerome did finishes on. We've had help along the way, but the help has always been A-list, top-notch. And the idea was that you know, we've dedicated our lives to making comics for some stupid reason, and we all wanted to have that one series that, if nothing else we do holds up, that we've got that one series that can be looked back upon as 32 issues of spectacular, fun comic books.
Well, yeah, and I think you've done it. I mean, the response we get every time we talk about it, and when a new issue comes out, it's like, no, don't let this end. So yeah, so hopefully someday it'll come back. But there's gonna, the long rumored omnibus is, it will be a reality at some point, right down the line, so people can get their collector itch done.
Yeah. I mean, I'm you know, Dark Horse said yes, and then now they say it's back in costing. So I don't know what's going on. But the idea, yeah, I'll do whatever it takes to get an omnibus made. There will be an omnibus if you're agent.
Excellent. So is there anything else on your plate, on your desk that you're working on, or is that pretty much, it's all pretty, now it's pretty much Marvel. I mean, how's the movie stuff going on? Can you tell us anything about that, or?
I can't. There's cool things happening with the American Crime movie, I can't. And there's also some new motion on a couple other things, but nothing worth talking about. That stuff is all magic, and I think the economy has made everybody very conservative, and so things are slow moving, but they are moving. I'd say right now that things moving with, you know, ahead of the pack would be Fear Agent and American Crime. Both seem to have some momentum and some good stuff going on, but no, I mean, if I'm working on anything else, I can't remember it, which probably isn't a good sign.
Well, good. Well, hopefully, you know, you can, now that Bulletstorm is done and you're in a good place at Marvel, you can kind of take some more time to relax a little and not slack off as much like you did last year. So,
we're not quite double shipping X-Force, but it's going to, like, I think every other month we're doing two issues. You know?
Oh, that's awesome. X-Fan me is very happy. So.
Yeah, I think, you know, so what I'm basically doing right now is, that's why I had to get up to issue 17. So I'm basically feeding a couple of artists at the same time to keep the book coming out on the schedule. So yeah, no rest, but hopefully good comics and stuff.
Yeah, I did kind of, I mean, we're on the phone here, so you can't see me, but when you said you're on issue 17, my eyes kind of bulged a little because I didn't think you'd be that far along. It's like Bendis ahead.
It's crazy ahead, and it's nice because I seed things in, like, you know, you'll realize in issue 6 there's a big thing that happens that you don't recognize that it's a big thing until issue 9, and then all of a sudden you go, hey, that thing in issue 6, goddamn. I've never been this far out, and not just to have like a, I have been because I've had rough outlines out, like on Punisher and Fear Agent, but I've never been this far out where I've got like fleshed out, beaded, you know, tight outlines that I've reworked with the editor. We've reworked these outlines, you know, no exaggeration, 6-7 times. So they're locked in, they're tight, they're great, and, you know, It's nice to front load your work that way if you have the time to do it.
Sure, totally. So so convention season's coming up. Are you going to be at any cons?
I will be at WonderCon. I will be at the. I had to cancel Seattle, unfortunately. It's like my favorite show, so that's a bummer. I think WonderCon is like the only thing that I've committed to. Maybe something this summer. Maybe I'm going to Calgary. Yeah, I am going. Anyway.
All right, so if anybody wants to see you, they need to come to San Francisco. That's basically what they need to do. They need to book their tickets now and come to San Francisco and hang out with Rick Remender.
That's right, yeah. in your city by the bay.
Exactly. It'll be good to welcome you back to San Francisco. So
have the parade ready.
Yeah. All right, Rick. Well, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. I don't want to take up more of your time, but thank you for coming by and talking to us about all the controversy and the fun comic books.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on again, Ron.
And a big thanks goes out to Rick Remender for giving us some time out of his very busy schedule. If you are a video gamer, definitely check out Bulletstorm. It's going to be up your alley. And for the comic books, definitely check out Uncanny X-Force and Venom. They both are kicking ass, and Venom looks like it's going to be really good. I know personally I can't wait for it. So be sure to head over to ifanboy.com to check out all of our other great podcasts as well as all the great writing there. If you have any questions or a creator you'd like to recommend we talk to, shoot us an email at contact@ifanboy.com. And until next time, I'm Ron, and enjoy your comics.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You ever feel like you really need to get something off your chest? This is like a real thing. Like, if you're mad, if you're upset, if there's something going on, like there's often for me an idea. Maybe it's a wrong. Maybe it's a moment. It's an injustice. It's something that because you keep going on and on, over and over. In your mind about it, and like that can create anger and resentment or shame, whatever it is. And very often, I have found, I am not a therapist, I have found that when you let it out, when you give it voice, when you say it out loud, sometimes it makes you feel better because you've expressed it, and sometimes it makes you realize like, oh, this is not a big deal, but it's been stuck in my head. So you give voice to those things, and it can make you feel a lot better. And shock of all shocks, therapy is one of those things that can help you do that. It can help you be able to say those things in a place where you don't need to worry about the repercussions of it, work your way through it, figure out coping skills, how to get around it, you know, find ways to deal with that stuff instead of letting it fester. If you are thinking of starting therapy, if anything I said sounds familiar, you're like, oh, maybe my life would be a little better if I could deal with that kind of thing. You should give BetterHelp a try. It's fully online. It is convenient, flexible. It is suited to your schedule. That's the idea. That's what they're going for. You can fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. That's a big deal. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. That personal connection, I believe, to be super important. Again, I'm not a professional. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. You get 10% off your first month. That is BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/iFanboy.